Last night we left the newly awakened Buddha at Bodh Gaya, contemplating the question of whether or not to teach, and he was strangely reluctant to do so. He had to be talked into it, and we reflected on why that might be and looked at perhaps his background. He himself was such a fanatical, conflicted young man, driven to this awakening, that he might have thought, if I'm going to teach someone, I've got to teach people who are like me, and how on earth can I get through to them? So he, under the best of circumstances, he's got a very difficult job. Remember, he said, this Dharma that I've discovered is deep, difficult, profound, etc., etc. Very hard to penetrate, very hard to understand. How on earth can he communicate it? And especially, how on earth can he communicate it to people like him, members who of his own community of strivers, people striving for enlightenment? The strategy that he hit upon, he discovered with his first discourse, Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. Now, he attained the awakening on the full moon of Vaisakha, which is roughly May. It's a lunar calendar, Indian lunar calendar, so I think April, May. And the first discourse was taught 2 months later, on the full moon of Asalha in July. So he spent about 6 weeks in and around Bodh Gaya, and I guess about 2 weeks to walk to Sarnath, what is now called Sarnath. He was wondering who to teach. He first thought of his original teachers, his two old meditation teachers that he walked out on earlier, Alara Kamala and Uddaka Ramaputta, but using his psychic powers, he realised that they were both dead. They had just missed out. So then he thought of his five companions. Now these, the five companions, these are the five equally fanatical characters who joined him in his ascetic phase. And they formed a very loose community of some sort. Siddhartha, as he then was, eventually realised he was wasting his time with asceticism, and tried something else. And in trying something else, he abandoned the path of flogging himself, starving himself to death. And his companions were quite disgusted by this. Should I use the microphone? Can you hear me at the back?
Yeah.
I'll use the microphone. Is that better?
Yeah.
Yeah? So, the Buddha's five companions were disgusted when he gave up on his ascetic practices, and they walked away from him, or he walked away from them, or maybe they walked away from each other. Again, fanatics unwilling to compromise. They went to Varanasi, to a place north of Varanasi called Isipatana, which is now called Sarnath. And so the Buddha decides he will teach them. And he heads off to Varanasi to do this. It's recorded that on his way, he met an Ajivaka. The Ajivakas were another sect of ascetics. This guy was called Upaka. And Upaka meets the Buddha. They're walking in opposite directions. And Upaka is immediately struck by the Buddha's appearance, his radiance, the power emanating from him. And so Upaka knows that something has happened. So he's interested, he's curious. And he says, so who is your teacher? And what does your teacher teach? And the Buddha launches into this dramatic poem in which he declares, I have no teacher, I have no equal, I am the Buddha, I am the supremely awakened one. And I go now to roll the wheel of the Dharma and open the gates to the deathless, and so on. And Upaka basically says, yeah, whatever, and walks off, completely unimpressed, which is quite interesting. The Buddha's first, the first time he's really invited to communicate his awakening, when he's ready to do it, he's a complete schmozzle, total failure. He still, at this point, hasn't worked out how to do it. What he relies upon is what's called a declaration of truth. In the Buddhist tradition, truth has power. To simply say something which is true is to manifest power. And of course, power in a shamanic culture is very important, because they work with power, with energy. And truth is one source of power. So the Buddha gives Upaka the full blast, and it doesn't work. So on he goes. He goes to Isipatana, north of Varanasi, where he meets the five companions. And at first, they don't want to talk to him. As far as they're concerned, he's a backslider, and they want nothing to do with him. But, and he tries to persuade them to listen to him, but they won't have it. And finally, he gives them a declaration of truth. But this declaration comes in the form of a question. And he says to them, Have you ever known me to speak like this before? And they say, no, we never have. We've never, the Buddha is saying, have you ever known me to claim awakening? Or claim anything? And they said, no. And he says, well, I'm claiming it now. And then they listen. So here we have the declaration of truth, but it has an impact. It works. And if we ask why, it's because these guys know him. At this point, they don't particularly like him. In fact, you get the impression that he's not really a very likeable character. But they know him and they respect him. They know he would never lie. He might be the kind of character you can't live with, so they left. But they know he would never lie. So if he says he's got it, well, he's got something, and it's worth listening to. So he breaks through their initial defences, and he gets them to actually listen to what he has to say. But he still is faced with the problem, how do I communicate this awakening to these people? And this is how he starts off. The discourse begins. This is how I heard it. Once the Blessed One was living at Varanasi in the deer park at Isipatana. There he addressed the group of five bhikkhus, although at this point they're not bhikkhus. So I'm not quite sure why the text calls them bhikkhus. Bhikkhus, these two extremes must not be followed by one who has gone out into homelessness. What two? The pursuit of sensual happiness among sensual pleasures, which is inferior, normal, the way of ordinary people, lacking in refinement, and useless. And the pursuit of the practice of self-exhaustion, which is painful, lacking in refinement, and useless. Avoiding both these extremes, the Tathagata has awakened to the middle way that gives rise to seeing and understanding and leads to calming, direct knowledge, full awakening, nibbana. And what is the middle way that gives rise to seeing and understanding and leads to calming, direct knowledge, full awakening, nibbana? This noble eightfold path, right view, right aspiration, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right energy, right mindfulness, and right unification. Can anybody hear me? Is yep? Good. So, this is the opening of the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, turning the Dharma wheel, or setting in motion the wheel of the Dharma. And this is recorded as the first discourse. But the obvious question is, in what sense is it the first? because this is not the first time that the Buddha taught. He was teaching back at Bodhgaya. He taught Upaka. Why is this discourse number one? Why is it counted as the first? It's counted as the first, not numerically, but because this is the first time that the wheel of the Dharma turned. This is the first time that someone actually understood what he was saying. So what is being celebrated in the idea of the first discourse is not so much the teaching, although that's important, but the effect of the teaching. Someone actually got it. That someone was Kondanya. He was one of the five companions. And he gets it at the end of the discourse, which we'll get to tomorrow. And when he gets it, what happens to him is he has the vision of Dharma, the Dhamma Chakku, and attains what is called stream entry. This is the first level of enlightenment or awakening, when one enters the stream of the Dharma. It marks the first direct encounter with the unconditioned, with Nibbana, and the result of it is there's a fundamental turning around of the mind at its deepest level. And from now on, the person is simply not walking the path, but being swept along by it. And so their awakening is inevitable. It will happen, maybe not this lifetime, but it will happen. The tradition says that within seven lifetimes, one will be fully awakened. Seven, of course, is a symbolic number indicating completion, the completion of a cycle. This is the stage of irreversibility. It's called stream entry. You have that sense that you will not fall back from now on. You'll just go forward. And falling back is a major problem from the Indian perspective. Anybody ever played Snakes and Ladders? Where you move up the ladders and slide down the snakes. Or do you slide down the ladders and move up the snakes?
Climb
up the ladders and slide down the snakes. And so it's kind of up and down, up and down, up and down. That game was invented in India. And it illustrates samsara. This is what samsara is all about. Samsara, life after life, the idea of life after life in Europe, in the West European tradition, in the Western world, is invariably, it's usually associated with New Age, and it's invariably presented as an escalator. Mm-hmm. It's like you just go up,
yeah.
And at each floor of the department store, you learn something new, and then you move up to the next one. This is not the Buddha's view of life after life. The Buddha's view is more like it's a cosmic game of snakes and ladders, and you're sure you spend this lifetime being diligent and good and virtuous, and next lifetime, whammo, you're right back down there. You're much further down. Because it's this vast cosmic storm that we're being blown about in. And we've got no control over the winds. And we're just being blasted around. But stream entry cuts through that. And from now on, it's all ladders, no snakes. So it's good news, basically. And when Kondanya gets it, according to the commentary, which is written about 1,000 years later, 18 million devas got it as well. Bingo. And they, in other words, the whole universe moved. This is a cosmological event. The Dharma wheel has started to turn. You notice that it did not turn with the Buddha's awakening. It was still. It only turns when someone else gets it. Why is that? Well, there's this guy, you know, in the forest somewhere who gets enlightened. That's great. Solves his problem. Leaves the rest of us completely unchanged. Mm. So that is not a cosmic event. It's nice, but it's not a cosmic event, an event of cosmic significance. But when other people start to get it, when there's a momentum going, when it starts to spread, that has cosmological significance. And this is what's being celebrated is in the and as the first discourse. Now, the Buddha is searching for a strategy. How is he going to get through to these people? And the strategy that he hits upon is the middle way. These two extremes should not be followed by one who has gone out into homelessness. To go out into homelessness is to embark on the spiritual journey. Avoiding both these extremes, the Tathagata has awakened to the middle way. Tathagata is one of the most ancient titles of the Buddha. The Buddha referred to himself as the Tathagata. That's a Tathagata is one who is just come, just gone, just here, nothing sticking at all. There's different. So the middle way, this is a famous expression. I think pretty much anybody who's heard of Buddhism has heard of the middle way. And the middle way is presented in various ways throughout the teachings. I don't know of any other discourse. Well, in this teaching, the Buddha presents it as the middle way between the two extremes of the pursuit of sensual happiness among sensual pleasures, on the one hand, and the pursuit of the practice of self-exhaustion, on the other. The practice of self-exhaustion being the ascetic practices. And I don't know of any other discourse in which the Buddha talks about the middle way like this. The most common or most well-known presentations of the middle way would be the between the extremes of existence and non-existence and between eternalism and annihilationism. And we won't go into these because it takes us into philosophical territory that we don't need to go into. But essentially, these are both presentations of dependent arising, paticca-samuppada, which we briefly talked about last night. The middle way is a broad principle. You could say that the teaching itself, the entire teaching, is the middle way. What we have in the first discourse is a specific application of a general principle applied to the specific audience that the Buddha had in front of him. Remember that the Buddha's project here, he's not thinking of an audience 2,500 years down the track. He's thinking about these five people right in front of him. He's got to break through to these five people. Context is everything. The discourse begins. First of all, it begins, "This is how I heard it." It's an oral tradition. Nothing was written down. This was memorized and chanted. In other words, the discourse is not a text in our normal sense of the word. It's a performance. It's a chant. And it begins, "Once the Blessed One was living at Baranasi in the deer park at Isipatana, there he addressed the group of five." So, once, time, the Blessed One was living at Baranasi in the deer park at Isipatana, place, there he addressed this particular group of five. Occasion. Time, place, occasion. Most of the discourses start in this way. In other words, the first thing they do is to set the context. At this place, at this time, when this happened, the Buddha said, blah, blah, blah. In other words, had he turned up the next day, he might have said something different. Had it been the same day, but somewhere else, he might have said something very different. Had it been the same place, the same day, but a different audience, it would have been something different. The Buddha tailored his teaching to the specific situation in front of him. So you don't get in the discourses a systematic explanation of the whole thing. You just don't find it. They're like, the discourses are like little flashes. Has anybody worked with a relational database?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I did at one time in my working career. If you have a database is a table, so you've got columns and rows, and each column represents a particular type of information, and that table is a database. Let's say you have another database, and one of the columns in this table is the same as a column in the other table. Would that be right? Is that the way it works? Any experts? Yeah? Good. My memory's correct.
The start.
So you can link the two tables via that column that is in common. Then you have another table where one of the columns in the second table is the same as one of the columns in the third one. You can make a link. Then you have another table. You make a link. Another. You can have 50 zillion tables. And you end up with an immensely complicated database from which you can pull out all sorts of interesting information. So what you do is you work out a question, a problem, you put it in, you program it, and the database spits out a report. And there you have it. Now, is the report the database? No. Let's say you had a collection of reports. Let's say 50 of them. Would that be the database? No. Let's say you had 50,000 reports. Would that be the database? No. A sutta, a discourse, is like a report generated by a very complex relational database. It's not. And the database is the Dharma. The discourse, the sutta, is not the Dharma. A whole collection of suttas is not the Dharma. Where do we find the Dharma? In the sense of the teacher. This is an old tradition. Where do we find the knowledge, the law, in an oral tradition? For example, Indigenous Australians. Where is the dreaming? Where do you find it? It's in the tribe. No one member owns it. No one person knows it, all of it. It's a community possession. And the Dharma is like this. In its earliest manifestation, it was in the minds of the monks and the nuns who memorized it and who practiced it. And to a lesser extent, lesser in the sense that they didn't memorize to the same extent, the lay people. These days, if we ask where is the Dharma in terms of the teaching, we would point to libraries, particularly university libraries. But in the Buddha's time, you'd point to people. These people know it. And they know it so well, they've embodied it so well, that when they come to a particular place, a particular time, a particular occasion, whammo, out it comes, appropriate to that specific situation. And this is, we're seeing a demonstration of it here. And this is the way that the Buddha taught, and one of the reasons why he's revered as such a great teacher. So, the Buddha is trying to communicate the Dharma, and the Dharma is very, very difficult to understand. So the Buddha needs to be very, very precise in the way that he communicates it. Why is the Dharma so difficult to understand? Well, there's a whole number of reasons, including its subtlety. But one reason relates to the Buddha's first realization of dukkha, of pain, which he had when he was still a young aristocrat living at home, when he was still Siddhartha. Remember we talked about how the Buddha, or Siddhartha, suddenly realized aging, sickness and death and the universality of it, and it shocked him to his core. And the weird thing about that is that he realized something which he already knew and which everybody already knows. And yet somehow it hit him extremely deeply. For some reason, at that moment, his armor was not on. His normal, habitual armor was not on. And then the truth of dukkha really penetrated and shocked him to his core. The Dharma is hard to understand because in order to understand it, we have to drop our armour. We have to be vulnerable. We have to be open to actually seeing the human condition as it is now, here. And that is quite a dangerous thing. Some people, when their armour drops and they're suddenly open and completely sensitive to what's going on and they have some kind of realisation, it can drive people mad. It can drive people crazy. People end up in mental homes or being drugged to the eyeballs for the rest of their lives because, particularly at a young age, this is most likely to happen spontaneously in adolescence For Siddhartha, it actually came pretty late. And it can be profoundly disturbing. And communicated to the wrong person can be medicalized. You've got a serious problem. You are not normal. Take these drugs. It can easily happen. So it's quite dangerous to be open to the Dharma. So the Buddha needs to, first of all, find a way through the defences, and secondly, to show a way out of the existential problem that he's talking about. So people could, for example, someone might get extremely depressed. Why are you depressed? Because it's all futile. It's all meaningless. And so people will reassure them, no, it's not futile. No, it's not meaningless. Actually, it is. That's true. But how do you handle that? Unless you see a way through it to realise it's just okay. It doesn't have to have a meaning other than the one I give it. It doesn't have to be anything other than futile. Futile is fine. It's actually not a problem with it. It's just the way it is. It's only a problem because I don't want it to be futile. I expect it to be something else. But as soon as I accept what it is, then I can work with it. So it's not enough. First of all, we've got to penetrate the armour. And then we have to be given some way out of the situation that we find ourselves in. So it's a very delicate matter to teach this Dharma. Now, the audience that the Buddha is talking to, these five companions, these are advanced practitioners. And the practice, the tradition in which they practice is one of severe asceticism, which is, again was fairly common in India at the time. The basic principle is that sukha, happiness, comes from enduring dukkha, pain. And when the Buddha talks about the rejection of the two extremes and the discovery of something new, it's in the context of the rejection in particular of that tradition, the tradition of asceticism. So the Buddha, So the Buddha says, these two extremes should not be followed by one who has gone out into homelessness. What two? The pursuit of sensual happiness among sensual pleasures, which is inferior, normal, the way of ordinary people, lacking in refinement and useless, and the pursuit of the practice of self-exhaustion, which is painful, lacking in refinement and useless. Now, really, the emphasis here is not on the first one, the rejection of sensual happiness among sensual pleasures. Both the Buddha and his companions have already rejected that. In other words, in contemporary terms, they've all of them seen through consumerism. They know it's a crock. They know it doesn't work. They're quite clear about that. They know that the pursuit of happiness does not consist in getting more, having more, being more, and so on. They've already figured that out. They don't have to be told. The emphasis here is on the second one, because that's their tradition. That's where they are stuck. And the Buddha is saying that what they're doing, their path of practice, is futile. It doesn't work. And the whole thing revolves around the twin issues of sukha and dukkha, pleasure and pain, happiness and misery. Normal human beings pursue happiness through happiness. If only I get what I want, then I'll be happy. So it could be a position, a job, it could be money, it could be a nice house, it could be the right person to live with, it could be the nice little kitties, scrubbed, 2.5, the nice car in the driveway, it could be being normal, or whatever. But if only I get what I want, then I'll be happy. So this is pursuing sukha through sukha. The five companions and the Buddha, when he was in his ascetic phase, saw that doesn't work. We'll try the opposite. What we will do is pursue sukha through dukkha. We will voluntarily undergo pain in order to overcome it, and in overcoming pain, break through to a higher level of happiness. So, obviously, to pursue this path, you're in a small cultural minority, and secondly, there's a certain fanaticism, there's a certain stubbornness required to pursue this path. And these are the people that the Buddha is talking to. And of course, again, he's looking at himself. He's looking in the mirror when he speaks to these five characters. Now, this path of self-inflicted pain should be the right path. Why should it be the right path? Because it's the opposite of the wrong path. The wrong path is pursuing happiness through happiness, consumerism. So if that's the wrong path, the right path has to be the opposite. It's obvious. What the Buddha is saying in the middle way is that it's wrong because it's the opposite. That's why it's wrong. That's why it doesn't work. Instead of being driven by desire, like most people, this path is driven by aversion. But it's still driven. And that's the problem. So the Buddha is saying one extreme is consumerism, what we would call consumerism. The other extreme is asceticism. Asceticism doesn't work because it's the opposite of what doesn't work. Consumerism doesn't work for the same reason. It's the opposite. The middle way is between them. So he's coming at it from a new angle, a new direction. And the whole thing revolves around desire. The Buddha is presenting a new understanding of desire. He calls it tanha. Literally it means thirst. We'll meet this later in the discourse where we go through the four truths. Tanha literally means thirst. It's usually translated craving. And craving is desire, but it's desire which also contains aversion. Aversion is the shadow of desire. If I want this, I don't want that. If I want to be spiritual, I don't want to be mundane. If I want to be enlightened, I don't want to be deluded. And so on. So where there's a desire that contains its opposite, its shadow, as its shadow, you have craving, which is a quality of drivenness. The middle way avoids both of those opposites, both of those extremes. It's found somewhere else. So, if we're considering this middle way, we could see it in the problem of effort, which as meditators we're quite familiar with. If we practice meditation, we have to make effort. There's work involved. It's not just relaxation. It's hard work, as we've all discovered. So, if I just come into the hall and just relax, I'm not going to get very far with the meditation. I might end up being quite relaxed, but I'm not going to get far with the meditation. So, I come in and I make effort. I have to make effort to stay with the meditation object. And the problem is that realizing that I've got to work at this and not slack off, I then push myself. Work, work, work. And at some point, I just get fed up with it. I don't know about you. Perhaps you've never gotten fed up with it. But certainly with me, I'd work. And you're like, God, enough. Give me a break. Just, you know, it might be sit during the period. Bong, the bell goes. Phew. Foom, out the door, up to the veranda, guzzling the cup of tea, admiring the view. Phew, take a break. Ah, bong, bong, there goes the bell again. Right, down into that hall. Got to do it. Effort. Collapse. Really strain and collapse. This is a very common pattern among meditators. Try, fall back and take a break. Try, collapse. Now, this problem is closely associated with our relationship to time. When I'm straining, why am I straining? It's because I want something. And what I want isn't here. Because if it was here, I wouldn't need to strain, would I? So I'm trying to get to a nice meditation, to an acceptable meditation. And I don't know exactly what this is. I just know that I haven't got there yet. So I'm doing this now in order to get that later on. So what I've got to do is push through this, which isn't obviously satisfactory, to get to that, which will come later on. It might come tomorrow. Tomorrow it'll be okay. I mean, the first couple of days is pretty awful. But the third day, it should be okay. Well, it's not okay, not the third day, but the fifth day. Things should be reasonable by the fifth day. Or it might be, I've just got to get through this breath. I've just got to hang on to this inhalation. Because then I'll have concentration. But it's always later. So I'm pushing through what's happening now to get to something that will happen later on. What is it that's pushing me? What's driving me? It's what the Buddha calls tanha. Craving. So, and driven by craving, I am trapped in these two extremes. I'm either going to be straining or I'm going to be collapsing. It may be in a gross way. It may be in a very subtle way. It can be very subtle. Have you ever had the experience of meditating away and the meditation is really, really good? It's like you've really got there. And you're very satisfied and very pleased with it. And you feel that you could sit there forever because it's so peaceful. And then you hear the lunch bell. You think, whoops, time to go. Apparently it wasn't that great after all. Or, you know, the bell at the end of the period, and you go, phew. So there's still that quality of something extra, some bit of strain in there that's muddying the water to some extent. When this is happening, we're caught in what the Buddha calls anta, an extreme. And if we're caught in one extreme, sooner or later, we'll be in the opposite and we'll be bouncing between them. So the middle way can only be found where there are no extremes. In other words, where we are not stuck on anything. So the middle way is not halfway between the two extremes. We'll measure them out, get the ruler. Exactly halfway, that's the middle way. Moderation. Often it's misinterpreted in that way. I mean, the Buddha, whatever else the Buddha was, he was not moderate. No. Let's face it. The middle way is found in a dynamic balance between extremes, between opposites, and it's characterized by no fixed position. Where there is no fixed position, there we find the middle way. And this balance and this lack of fixedness, this lack of stuckness, can only be found in the present. It cannot be found in either the past or the future. It can only be found in the present. If we are striving for something to happen in the future, we ain't in the middle way. If we're hanging on to the past, He ain't in the middle way. It can only be found now. And so the first definition that the Buddha gives of the middle way is, and what is the middle way that gives rise to seeing and understanding and leads to calming, direct knowledge, full awakening, nibbana? This noble eightfold path, right view, right aspiration, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right energy, right mindfulness, and right unification. Now, we don't have time to go through all these, but I just want to draw attention to the fact that the path has eight factors. In other words, it's a complex system. It's dynamic. These eight factors, for the path to function, must be balanced. Imagine being a juggler with eight balls in the air, going steadily. Very dynamic. A single moment of hesitation and the whole thing collapses. It's about balance between dynamic factors. And this is why we're constantly losing it and coming back, losing it, coming back, losing it and coming back. We're constantly seeking that balance. But it's dynamic. It's not that we get it once and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
We've got to do it again.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to do it now. It's not good enough to have done it a moment ago or a year ago. We have to do it now. Or as that very wise man, Ricky Stewart, once commented when he was playing for the Canberra Raiders, you're only as good as your last game. And this is a fundamental principle of Buddhism. So it's a dynamic balance, and in terms of the Eightfold Path structure, you've got eight factors. All of them have to be balanced within themselves and with each other. So you get this very dynamic system which we're playing with all of the time. So a sense of dynamic balance, that's where the middle way is to be found. And when we lose the balance, then we get stuck. We get stuck somewhere. And we're always getting stuck. And the trick is to recognise it and move on. So the Buddha, first of all, presents the middle way, which we've just briefly touched upon. And then he goes on to the four truths, which we'll have a brief look at now, but look at in more detail tomorrow. This is the noble truth of dukkha. Birth is dukkha, aging is dukkha, sickness is dukkha, death is dukkha, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair are dukkha. Association with the unloved is dukkha, separated from the loved is dukkha, not getting what one wants is dukkha. In brief, the five aggregates associated with clinging are dukkha. This is the noble truth of the arising of dukkha. It is craving, tanha, which leads to further becoming, is bound up with obsession and delight, and finds its delight now here, now there, specifically craving for sense pleasures, craving for existence, and craving for non-existence. This is the noble truth of the cessation of dukkha. It is the complete cessation of that very craving, abandoning it, renouncing it, releasing it, letting it go. This is the noble truth of the way leading to the cessation of dukkha, the noble eightfold path of right view, right aspiration, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right energy, right mindfulness, and right unification. So he presents the middle way. You notice how he first defines the middle way as the Eightfold Path. He then expands it into the Four Truths, and he's back to the Eightfold Path. Circles within circles. Go back to the database. Reports intersecting with reports. It's like that all the time. Dealing with a complex system. But the basic model that he puts forward here are the four truths. They all revolve around this concept of dukkha. And dukkha is clearly important because it's about what the Buddha is talking about here is practice. He's talking to practitioners. He's talking to people who are already totally committed to the path for liberation. Why does one commit oneself to the path of liberation? Because we experience dukkha. That's why. Or to put it another way, what the hell are you people doing here? It's a nice evening. You're probably on holidays. You've got better things to do with your time, haven't you? You could be in Byron, enjoying yourselves. But here you are, sitting on the floor, meditate, meditate, meditate. Why? It's because everybody in this room has had some understanding, some realization of the first truth. We all know it. That's what brings us here. That's what gets us started. Yeah. So dukkha is the beginning of action, the beginning of practice. The path begins with dukkha. That's the way it happened for Siddhartha. And that's the way it happens in one way, form or another, with everyone. So he starts by analysing dukkha. We don't have time to go into it in any detail. First of all, the term itself, dukkha, usually translated suffering, it's a very inadequate translation. The problem that we have, and we meet it again and again when dealing with the Buddha's teaching, is that the Buddha was very precise with language, and he developed a whole technical vocabulary with words that have no English equivalent. There is no English equivalent to the word dukkha. It comes from ka, which is an old Vedic word for an empty space, for example, found in the hub of a wheel, and the prefix du, which denotes bad, rotten, lousy, awful, ghastly, unpleasant, and so on and so forth. And the opposite of dukkha is sukha. So ka has some different meanings. First of all, the hub of a wheel, the wheel of the Dharma. So again, movement, dynamism. For the wheel to move the vehicle, the axle needs to fit through that the hub. If the fit isn't right, the wheel doesn't turn properly. So a badly fitting axle, and the vehicle either gets stuck, or if it moves at all, it's with a great deal of difficulty and grind. This is dukkha, the sense of grind, of difficulty that we have in our lives. Another way of looking at dukkha is ka is the emptiness at the core of our being. So we all have this sense that there's something missing, something not there that should be there. We all have this sense of inadequacy, that I'm not good enough yet. And so we need to fill that gap. So dukkha is associated with tanha. Tanha is thirst. It's like we're empty inside, and so we're thirsty, and so we consume, we drink in order to fill the gap and quench the thirst, but it never happens. Doesn't matter how much we take, doesn't matter how much we do, there's something missing. So that sense of a painful emptiness at the core of our being is dukkha. And it can be very, very subtle or very, very gross. And dukkha covers the whole range of unpleasantness, of pain. Sometimes people these days will translate it as unsatisfactoriness in order to get a more general sense. But that doesn't work either. As Lawrence Mills pointed this out in a discussion a couple of years ago, a group of people, he said, let's say that, well, I'll give my own examples. Let's say that we're doing the retreat and we go up to lunch and the spread today is particularly magnificent. It's really, really good lunch that they've laid out. So we go through and pile up the plate, head back, sit down, with total mindfulness and concentration. We gobble it down. And then we think about seconds. So we get up and head back to the table for seconds. But the problem is, we've only got a little bit of room left that we can shovel more food into. And there's two or three dishes that I really like to try again. And to get a decent hit of any one of them, I've got to give up the other two. Or if I take a bit of all three, it's only a miserable little smidgen. That's dukkha. Now, if I turned to my companion and said, look, I'm really suffering here because of this, then my companion is likely to say, get real. That's not suffering, mate. But it is dukkha. Or let's take another situation. I'm in the hospital. I've had this horrendous, painful and slow, incurable disease for a long time. I've learned to live with chronic pain, but it's just got worse and worse and worse. And finally, I'm basically locked in this prison of a hospital. I've lost all agency. I'm just being prodded and poked by the medical profession, kept artificially alive, hating every moment of it, but afraid to die, and utterly, utterly alone. So a nurse comes up, writes in the chart, looks down, oh, the situation seems to be unsatisfactory. No. It's suffering. It's also dukkha. So both of those situations and everything in between covers dukkha. So it's a very broad and deep term. I often give the dukkha test. It's a thought experiment. If you consider your situation right now, as you're sitting in this hall, listening to this talk, is there anything about this situation right now that you would change if you could? If there is, you have dukkha. So it's all pervasive. So this is what the Buddha starts with. So dukkha, the first truth. Second and the third are the arising of dukkha and the cessation of dukkha. Now you notice what he does. He starts with one thing and then he opens out into two. And so suddenly there's a relationship. If there's two, there's a relationship. And he makes that very clear because the second truth is the arising of dukkha. The third is the cessation. Again, dynamics, movement. It starts, it begins, so it ends. It comes, so it goes. It's dynamic. And when it comes and goes because of something else. Is that familiar from last night? Yeah. Dependent arising, specific conditionality. What is the specific condition which gives rise to dukkha? Tanha, craving, thirst. The sense of drivenness. So tanha is that the drivenness that we all experience, which again can range from the most subtle to the most gross. So the addict is driven, got to have more, whatever the substance is. And it's interesting that along with consumerism, we get epidemics of addiction in all sorts of ways. They go hand in hand. It can be quite subtle, a sense of driven necessity. Have you ever had an itch? Mm-hmm. Have you ever scratched it? How often have you hesitated before scratching it? How often have you just filed it away of, yeah, I'll get to that in the next half hour or so? Or is it just that driven, that sense of driven necessity, I've just got to do this, then it'll be okay, is classic. This is tanha. This is craving. Very subtle, but that's how it works. Just got to do this, just got to get this. Then it'll be okay. Then I'll relax. And it's always another then, and another one, another one, and another one. And it can manifest either as what we would call desire, I want, or it can manifest equally as aversion, I don't want. I've just got to get rid of this. I've just got to adjust my posture. Then I'll be able to meditate. I've just got to take a break, and then I'll be able to do it. But I've got to take the break now. This is craving. And where there is craving, there is dukkha. If there's big craving, there's big dukkha. If there's a little craving, there's a little dukkha. But they go hand in hand. If craving ceases, dukkha ceases. So the whole project of working with dukkha and coming to the cessation of it, which is enlightenment, it has to do with a dynamic relationship and it's the relationship with our drivenness, our disordered heart. That's what the project is all about. And that's what we're studying when we do this meditation. It's amazing how people will say, oh, I can't meditate because I'm so disturbed.
What?
Mate, we're meditating because we are quite disturbed. That's why we're doing it. That's what we're studying. That's what we're getting to know. So, tomorrow we'll continue with this discourse, looking at, in particular, the truths. Actually, I've already anticipated some of it. And we'll go into, we'll have a look at the four truths and ask the question, when the Buddha talks about truth, what does he mean? In other words, are the four truths a Buddhist creed? This is what we are expected to believe. Or is he talking about something else entirely? So that's what we'll look at tomorrow night. But for tonight, that's enough. So thank you. Thank you.